I'm Anthony Walsh, and this is the Roadman Cycling Podcast, the show where we empower you with the tools to optimize your health, your happiness, and your longevity. Today, I get to chat with a legend from the world of mountain biking, Mr. Ned Overend. Often hailed as one of the pioneers in mountain biking, Ned's remarkable career includes multiple national and world championships. Today, he continues to inspire cyclists around the globe with his infectious passion for cycling. In this conversation, we'll dive into the origins, those sort of uneasy, unsteady, countercultural early days in mountain biking, his approach to training and racing, and how the sport has evolved over the years. I'd also encourage everyone to check out Ned's work over on outridebike.org. It's an amazing non-profit that are introducing over 50,000 young people annually to the amazing world of cycling. I'll leave the link for that in the show notes below. Here's a little taste of what awaits you today.
The very first guys in the repack and even in some of the first cross-country races, let's just say weed was not a banned substance at that time, marijuana. People talk about how, oh, full suspension and disc brakes and indexed shifting and electronic shifting, those are all huge leaps forward in mountain biking. But one of the biggest ones was tubeless tires. Because in the early days of mountain biking, you had to fix your own flats. Well, the Iron Horse Classic, that's always a big deal for me. I have done it, I think I've done it like 45 times. So that's a big deal. That gets some notice because I've done it so many times.
Hey, Roadman, today's episode is brought to you by our amazing clothing sponsor, Lacall. I bounced around cycling clothing brands for the better part of a decade until I found Lacall, and then I settled. The moment I put that kit on, I knew I was stuck. Founded by former Team GB cyclist Yanto Barker, Lacall isn't just another cycling brand. It's an apparel brand born out of professional cycling's heart and soul. I had Yanto on the podcast, and his mission, it shone bright in that conversation for me. He wants to create the ultimate cycling gear, and he's doing this by combining pro-level insights with the kind of technical details that make all the difference. So whether you're racing, you're training, or you're just enjoying the ride, it's an amazing piece of kit. Every piece of Lacall kit, it's tested to the limit, ensuring it stands up to the toughest rides. What really sets Lacall apart for me is how they've taken the feedback from the World Tour teams they've sponsored, working with top aerodynamicists, and they've incorporated that into all their kit. So whether you're pushing to beat your own personal best or you're just out enjoying the open road, Lacall's mission is help you get the most out of every single ride. Trust me, feeling good on the bike means performing well. And with Lacall, you're always in good hands. We've teamed up with Lacall to give you an amazing discount. If you head on over to lacall.cc and use the code ROADMAN20 at checkout, you're going to get 20% off your Lacall order. Ned, welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Anthony, great to be here.
Ned, paint me a little picture of what mountain biking was like. It's so hip, it's so cool now. What was it like when you were getting into it at the very start?
Well, it was, I know it was considered an extreme sport. And it was only cross country. This was before downhill. Mountain biking basically just started in cross country. And there is one caveat to that, in that the very first mountain bike races they were doing was called the Repack Downhill. So that was a downhill race. They were doing it on paperboy bikes with coaster brakes. That's why they called it Repack, because using coaster brakes, by the time they got to the bottom of the downhill, they needed to repack the bearings because the brakes got so hot that the grease all melted out of the hub. But besides that initial start, it then started to, they started to have cross-country races. Some of the very first races in the very early 80s was like the Pacific Sun Tour series, sponsored by Sun Tour. And that was all along the West Coast. That was one of the first series I did in 1983 that got me into the sport of mountain biking.
But year I was born?
Yeah, there you go. And it got a ton of press as kind of a radical sport, because you were riding these bicycles off-road, and a lot of the races were at ski areas, you know, so there was some a lot of steep, rough downhills on these, what we would consider a very primitive bike by today's standards. But ESPN, the Norba National Series, which a few years later developed, ESPN used to produce and show every single national race. And certainly then the World Championships, which first started officially by the UCI in 1990, that was on network TV as well. So there was a lot of press around it. It was new, it was growing fast. And once the UCI recognized it in 1990, that was the pathway to mountain bike racing getting in the Olympics. And the first time for that was 1996.
What was the crowd like? I'm trying to think of a modern parallel. Would it be something like a rock climbing crowd? Was it a little bit countercultural to movement back then?
I would say, well, certainly the very first guys in the repack and even in some of the first cross-country races, let's just say weed was not a banned substance at that time, marijuana. So, there was a lot of kind of hippie culture in the early days. And then as it became more competitive, you know, and the athletes got more focused on it, then I think there was less and less of that culture, at least at the top level.
So an interval kind of represented the gap between smoking weed rather than the gap between intense efforts.
Yeah. As it got more serious, you know, it got athletes that were more focused on training and less on partying.
What drew you to it?
Well, I was a mountain runner in 1980. I moved to Durango. My wife and I moved to Durango from San Diego. I went to San Diego State. And I'd gone to high school in the Bay Area. But I was a distance runner and mainly cross country. And I took a rock climbing class in Ouray, which is outside of Durango, and it actually is ice climbing. And I saw this region of the country because I drove there from San Diego to do this ice climbing class in Ouray. And I was really impressed with it. It was so beautiful, smaller town. I was kind of tired of living in big cities. So my wife and I moved to Durango, which was close to Ouray. And I was a mountain runner and a car mechanic. And like all runners, I developed some injuries and I turned to the bicycle and I began road racing in Durango. I was inspired by the Iron Horse Bicycle Classic, which a couple years ago, we had our 50th reunion for that 50th anniversary for that event. So it was a mountainous bike ride from Durango to the town of Silverton, a 11,000 foot pass and a 10,000 foot pass in there. So I excelled at that. And here I was a car mechanic and I thought, maybe I'm gonna consider becoming a professional cyclist. I'd moved up from a Cat 4 to a Cat 1 in a matter of like a little over a year, which was quick. And then right at that time, I began working at a bike shop instead of as a car mechanic, because I wanted to focus on cycling. Mountain bikes first started coming into the store. And I had, just out of high school, I used to be a motorcycle mechanic and ride motorcycles. So I was a mechanic. I had some motorcycle background for off-road riding. And I had been road racing, and here come mountain bikes and the mountain bike race scene just starting. And I was thinking to myself, this is perfect. Because I preferred a more individual sport as opposed to a team sport like road cycling. So I got on a Schwinn High Sierra and I started doing some races. And then I called the guys at Schwinn and they said we were looking to start a team. And I was part of the first team. It was run by Fred, a man named Fred Thiemann, who was running Schwinn's BMX team. And that was kind of the start of it, and it grew from there.
How long did it take you to pick up the skills? Because I guess coming from mountain running, physiologically, you're probably quite strong. And we've seen that crossover a lot from runners, rowers coming into road cycling, but less so coming into mountain biking, because I don't know exactly. We could probably speculate what the division is between physiological capacity and skills, but there's definitely a much greater skill demand in mountain biking than there is in road cycling. What's that transition like, or the learning curve?
Well, for me, it was easier because I had some motocross background. And when I was living in the Bay Area, I never raced pro motocross, but I did several motocross races, and I gravitated towards what was called hair scrambles, which were longer motorcycle events, like an hour and a half, and they required more endurance. So it's a matter of, you know, moving over rough ground as smoothly as possible. And you have suspension with the motorcycle, a lot more suspension than the bicycle, obviously. But even with the motorcycle, you're using your body as part of the suspension. You're standing up over the rougher ground. You're getting your weight back on the descents and stuff like that. So it was definitely advantageous to have that motocross background.
So when we're looking at a career as long as yours, what age were you when you got started? So when you're talking about those early years working in the bike shop, what age are you then?
I think 24, 25 is when I decided I'd like to pursue an athletic career.
So are you a continuous student of the sport? Are you continuously trying to learn new things? Or can you look back and say, you know, at some point in this journey, I hit a plateau and I stopped learning?
I'm still learning. I still learn every day. Or every race. Let's see. We did a group ride last Tuesday, and it was a slight downhill. We got incredibly competitive group rides here in Durango, as you might imagine. But it was strung out. I wasn't paying attention. Probably 35 miles an hour, and it was a bit of a crosswind. And about five of us got pinched off in the echelon. And we spent the whole next hour chasing. And I said to the guys, one of the guys was this kid named Josh, who is visiting town because they were recruiting him for Fort Lewis College to ride for their road team. And sure enough, Josh, who was 17 years old, I said, there you go. That's a lesson I've learned in the past. That's a learning opportunity for both of us. But constantly learning every time I, you know, get in a group or do an event.
What do you think the skills are for someone that's getting into mountain biking? Because I guess what I've seen in the last couple of years, and you probably have observed this as well, it's narrowing the gap between mountain biking and road cycling. We used to have these very distinct, like almost cults, for want of a better word. You have your road crew who are hardcore roadies and they got their customs and traditions. And then you have your hardcore mountain bike crew who again have their own history, tradition, group etic within that little cult group. But those lines of division have slowly begun to be eroded. And we've seen gravel as nearly a middle ground, which is kind of pulling a little in from each of them. Like you look at the US scene at the moment, Keegan Swenson from a mountain bike background is dominating the gravel. And then you've other guys like Alex Howes are up there, Lachlan Morton. So it's very much a melting pot. But when somebody's trying to make that initial transition from road into mountain bike or into gravel, what do you think those skills are that you should really focus on at the beginning?
One thing I've noticed, well, certainly the kids pick up the skills so quickly. And, you know, we have a Devo program in Durango, and these kids and women as well. When I ride with these kids that are 10, 11, 12, all the way up into their teens, it's amazing how fluid and natural and relaxed they are and how fast they are on the descents. So, I mean, if you were fortunate enough to pick it up as a kid, they tend to be riding at a really high level. There's a ton of crossover. Sepp Kuss comes to mind, Quinn Simmons. These are kids that started out mountain biking and have now, you know, become established road racers. I think that's a great direction to go as far as bike skills, because I think what happens in mountain biking, you get used to not being connected to the ground like you are in road racing. Your wheels are always drifting a little bit. It's not unusual for you to go into a two-wheel drift, but if you panic, you grab the front brake, then you crash. But if you do it often enough, you realize that if you just relax and make some body adjustments, then you can control the drift and it's a totally natural thing. So being on the dirt where you're where your wheels are not connected. The same thing happens in gravel, less often, but there are certainly some very technical gravel races. And I think in the beginning, probably guys like Keegan had an advantage over guys like Alex House. And of course, Alex House has done it so much, you know, he's improved his skills to where I don't think the mountain bikers are dropping the former road racers in gravel anymore. I think they've developed those gravel skills. There's a ton of really technical gravel events. I'm shocked sometimes at the stuff that they put the gravel bikes through. It's like they want to throw in mountain bike sections in gravel races just to, you know, test the skills of the riders and stuff like that. All the gravel courses are so different.
Yeah, what I've noticed racing against the mountain bike guys in gravel events is, like, coming from a purely road racing background, I can follow them on most of the descents, but it's the level of effort, focus, and concentration that I'm putting in the descent. It's almost like there's a extra glycogen demands for me to follow them on those descents. So even though I may be not getting dropped on those descents, they're staying a lot fresher than I am on those descents. So that's energy they can then deploy later in the race. And I've also noticed that whatever about on the road, if you miss an apex on a long alpine descent on the road, not the end of the world, you can normally correct. If you miss an apex on a fast gravel descent, oh, it's tough to get your line back. Like, you're scrubbing a lot of speed to get back going again. So there's definitely different demands to it that I think, you know, when you're so ingrained in that mountain bike culture, it's nearly automated for you probably. But I think us roadies are maybe, we're a lot more mechanical and we have to think a lot more about the stuff that just comes so natural to you.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about basically is relaxing. I mean, that's oversimplifying it. But when you're relaxed on the descent, the roughness of the road is not being transmitted into your body as much. You've got more confidence to stay off the brakes in the turns, so you're carrying more momentum through the turns. You're not having to pedal out of it to catch guys. And it's classic when John Tomac jumped into mountain bike racing back in the day at a course like Mammoth, where it would have a huge climb, maybe a half-hour climb and a 15-minute long descent. He was a superb downhiller, an excellent downhiller. You know, he would win the downhill races at Mammoth, a separate event. And I was a better climber, but when I would chase him on those downhills, we'd get to the bottom of those downhills and my heart rate would be just like I was climbing the hill. It'd be through the roof because I was so tense and I was having to pedal so much more than him. And he was just kind of laying off the brakes and just smoothly flowing down the hill. And he was totally recovered at the bottom of the descent. So it forced me to really focus on how to downhill more efficiently, you know, as well as quickly. I mean, they go hand in hand, but it's a matter of, you know, it sounds simple, right? You relax and how you brake, because braking just transmits a lot more shock into your body. So you try and brake in smooth sections and not brake when it's rough. On the brakes hard, then get off of them, as opposed to dragging the brakes, which is just constantly causing extra vibration put into your body.
Yeah, that's something I've really noticed. The good guys seem to brake less, but when they brake, they're braking harder.
Right, and have your body positioned in the right way so that you can brake hard and get traction with your tires. Right, you gotta have your weight back, and you know, most of your braking power is in your front brake. But in order to utilize that power, your weight has to be way back in order to focus the weight behind pushing that tire into the ground so it doesn't lock up, so it actually grips while you're braking.
My Wheat is hands down the best virtual cycling app for home, and it's redefining indoor training at no cost. Yep, it's completely free. And setting up My Wheat is really easy. You just download the My Wheat app, connect to your device like your Watt bike or your smart trainer, and off you go. If you're feeling competitive, there are weekly races for every category from beginner to pro. Plus, there's insane prize money up for grabs. And if you've no plans to race, that's no problem. There's hundreds of free training plans and workouts that are designed to push your limits. You can join daily group rides and group workouts, and you can customize your avatar, all without opening your wallet. So go on over to the MyWish app and have a look around. Why would you spend on monthly subscriptions elsewhere when MyWish offers all of this for free? So join MyWish today. It's available on iOS, macOS, Google Play, Apple TV, or you can click on the link in the show notes to get started.
We have this local Strava segment. It's probably 11 minutes long. It's kind of technical single trail, and there's some rock gardens in it, a couple of small little jumps. It's rutted in parts. And I was out recently on my gravel bike, and I hadn't ridden it before on either my gravel or a mountain bike. And I rode it on my gravel bike, and I just having a bit of fun, I said, I'm going to go for the Strava segments on this. And I went for it. Like, I felt like I rode it once. I kind of had an eye for where everything is, and I had such a perfect like run at this on the gravel bike. And I was coming through at the end. I was like, I don't think that could be done much faster on a gravel bike. I was like, I wonder how close I got to the mountain bike record on the Strava section. And I was like 2.5 or 3 minutes off the segments section. I was like, how is it possible to go 2.5 or 3 minutes faster on that? And I came back out a week later and I rode it on my Factor Lando full sus. And it was incredible where I had to pick lines, where I had to kind of say to myself, I'm going to go to the left of this rutted section where I'm going to, you know, try and skirt around this rock. I just went straight over everything and I was 90 seconds faster. I still didn't get the segments, but I was 90 seconds faster. And I was wondering, and I said, when I got the opportunity to talk to somebody who'd been in the industry for a long time, I wondered that experience almost mirrored evolution in the mountain bike over those years, because that was a pure technological advancement that I experienced. That time wasn't a product of me getting fitter, wasn't the product of me knowing the trail better. It was just better tires, better suspension, more bike that I needed. I was so under bike the first time.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many developments in the mountain bike, right? But the reason the mountain bike in the very first place became kind of a tool, kind of a fun thing to do that people discovered was, and it came from, you know, they called it clunkers or cruisers, which were just paperboy style bikes, but they had fat tires. And then the guys started riding them off road and they realized, you know, the tires, if you run them lower pressure, you know, you get traction, it's more comfortable, you can actually have fun off-road. I mean, it was the basis of how mountain biking actually developed as a sport. And then you talk about full suspension. You know, that's something I'm involved with at Specialized, is developing cross-country full suspension. And it's something that we weren't even that focused on developing full suspension for downhill, because cross-country was so big in the early days of mountain biking. We were looking for an efficient cross-country full suspension system. And that's something I'm involved in. You know, it's called the Epic now, and we just launched a new bike.
But, unbelievable bike. We have an amazing Specialized store here in Dublin. It must be one of your flagship stores in the world. It's like the nicest boutique you've ever walked into. It's just, sometimes I drive past and I just walk around and I'm like, oh, this place is just, it's a nice experience to be in this place.
Yeah, I've heard about that store, but I haven't visited it in person.
You need to get over. We get you out for some mountain biking.
Yeah. It sounds good. I miss the, when you look at you mentioned the tire is so important, right? I mean, people talk about how, full suspension and disc brakes and indexed shifting and electronic shifting, those are all huge leaps forward in mountain biking. But one of the biggest ones was tubeless tires, because in the early days of mountain biking, you had to fix your own flats, and we had tubes in the tires, and we literally used to run them at 40 PSI in the front and like 44 in the back, rock hard with no suspension on the bikes. One of the biggest advancements was tubeless tires, because, I mean, that lets you, they run tires now at, they'll run 18 in the front and 21 in the back. in cross-country races. And the difference in control and speed that you can roll over rough ground is massive. It kind of is what has launched the gravel events as well, right? The just more clearance on a road bike for bigger and bigger tires. I mean, that's the biggest performance advantage you can have on rough ground in a gravel bike.
Pressure is something that's really been evolving in recent years. Like even road racing, when I started, you know, if you were doing a time trial, you were going 140 PSI. I spoke to Matt Bottrell, who's one of the best time trialists for the last decade in Ireland and the UK. And he was saying he used to put 160 in for the Nationals on his 19 mil tires. Like it's changed so much. I'm racing on the road now with a set of 28 mil GP5000s and I'm racing that 65 PSI. But when you're moving over, I ride my mountain bike probably twice a month, three times a month is all I ride it. And the rest of the time I'm riding my road bike. And one of the constant mysteries for me is like, what pressure should I be running on my shocks? What pressure should I be running on my tires? If I don't go with a friend who's a mountain biker, I'm kind of like, oh, I'll give it a squirt, I'll pinch it, I'll ride for a few minutes, go, okay, am I sliding out or I'll let out a bit, put in a bit. Is there a good rule of thumb for figuring out pressure in shocks and in tires?
Those are both big topics, right? Especially, I mean, you're talking about shocks and you're talking about tires. One way I like to set up my shocks is the O-ring on the shock. You go out, say the new Epic 8, it's got 120 mil travel front and rear. You set the O-ring on your shocks at the top. I mean, you begin setting your shock pressure with sag, right? And sag, I'll like roll around on the grass to make sure my suspension is settled in. Then I'll set those O-rings. And you generally want about 25% sag on a cross-country bike. Okay, so you want to have used up 25% of your travel. That's just a starting point. And then what I do is I go on a ride, and during the ride, if I'm going through a super rough, you know, fairly fast downhill, at the bottom of that downhill, I'll check those O-rings that are around the shock shafts. And I want to have used like 90, 95% of the travel. I want to know that my pressure is such that I'm actually getting all of the travel that, you know, this sophisticated suspension system has to offer. So yeah. I think they're very basic, but I will adjust my pressure based on that.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. That's the best I've ever heard somebody explain it.
Yeah. You want to make sure you're using the pressure. I mean, there's other things. Rebound is something that people don't understand that well. And rebound is how fast your shock comes back. So if your shock comes back too fast, it can have kind of a springing effect. And it'll top out at the top of the travel, and it'll come back too fast without enough dampening. So it doesn't help as well when it comes to soaking up the bumps. What you want is a little bit of rebound so that the shock comes back not at full force, but a little bit slowly. If you have too much rebound, then it becomes a real detriment to your suspension working, because the shock can't come back fast enough by the time it hits a successive series of bumps. So it's already stuck in its travel if it's not reacting quickly, right? So it doesn't have the full travel to engage the next bump. So it's called packing up. So too much rebound or too slow a rebound will cause your shock to pack up. And it'll almost be like you've got a rigid bike if your shock is packed up. So you want the rebound where it comes back pretty quickly, but not too quickly. Just a little bit of rebound is what I like in the front, and just a little bit more in the back. So that it's a little bit harder concept to grasp, but it's kind of the other. You have compression and you have rebound. So trying to embrace how those two damping systems work will really help you understand how to adjust them.
And on tires, is it as complicated, or is there online resources where you can point and say, okay, here's the bike weight, here's the rider's weight, here's the tire brand, here's the terrain, and then it spits out your PSI?
I've seen charts that put out that PSI, and they're a good starting point. And then it's got to be adjusted based on the course. because, you know, the biggest problem with running low pressure is puncturing or tearing your tire. You know, when if you have too low a pressure, the tire compresses against a rock or something, and then it compresses against the rim and tears the sidewall of the tire. So you have to have enough pressure for the roughest parts of the course you're on. You know, you might have a course with 80% fairly smooth ground, but if it's got a rock garden, you've got two choices. You've either got to have enough pressure in your tire to go through that rock garden fast, or you need to slow down when you go through those rocky parts.
I had a cyclocross pro on the podcast, and he suggested his way where he figured out his ideal pressure was he liked to feel the tire not quite, but just about bottom out on the very hardest part of the course, on the worst rock garden section of the course. That's how he gauged it.
Yeah. Okay, you got to look at cyclocross a little differently. One, because there's tire changes, right? And because generally people are using tubulars. So you can bottom out a tubular a lot of times and not puncture it because it's not necessarily being pressed up against the rim because the tire is kind of inside the rim. So it's different than a clincher tire, let's say. The other thing you have with cyclocross is that you've got wheel changes. So if you puncture, it's not the end of the world because, you know, you can get a bike change. So I would say that while that may work for cyclocross, a little more air than that is necessary for a gravel race or a mountain bike race.
So what's the trade-off? Obviously, when you go lower, you have a little bit more grip. But as pressure goes lower, is there a rolling resistance penalty?
It's surprising I'm reading the articles, how little that rolling resistance penalty seems to be in the different articles I've read from the companies that do these third-party tests on rolling resistance and tire pressure. And I mean, it's amazing back in the day when you talk about 160 PSI. When I first started racing, a road race with a 21 millimeter tire, I put 120 pounds of pressure in it. And evidently that was making us go slower is what we now know. Even on a fairly smooth tarmac, just the imperfections on a normal tarmac is enough to make you faster with lower pressure.
What do you think the next advancement's going to be in mountain biking? You touched on so many of those that have made the experience, you know, almost uncomparable from the early days you referenced to now, from electric gears to dropper C posts to, you know, amazing suspension. And we've seen a lot of focus now on drivetrain efficiency and wax chains and stuff recently. Where do you think we go next with all this?
I don't know that much about the technology, but when I look at a chain and a derailleur on a mountain bike in a muddy race, it just seems primitive. Doesn't it? I mean, I would think that developing internal geared systems, and I don't know about a drive shaft, but and people are still having problems. I mean, there's races where people are still throwing chains, and it's actually deciding events. You know, even with chain keepers on. I was just talking to Scott Simmons, who is Colby. He's the dad of Colby and Quinn Simmons. And Colby did Paris-Roubaix. It was super muddy and super rough, I should also say. And I think it was actually more of the roughness on the cobbles. Colby was in the lead group in the U23 Paris-Roubaix edition. Yeah. And he threw his chain. He had a chain keeper on, and the chain still came off and got stuck around the chain ring and the bottom bracket. So it seems like there is so much at stake. There's so much training that goes on, right? They're paying the athletes. So much comes down to these events, and yet they're decided by a mechanical, and to me, what seems like a primitive method of delivering power to the rear wheel. So there's a lot of challenges, right? There's weight and there's drag, you know, loss of watts and power in different mechanical systems.
Have you seen what Classified are doing with the hubs?
I have.
That's pretty interesting. I had a go on that and it was like magic.
Yeah. It seems like it makes a lot of sense to me because I think in one-by systems, you know, there's a lot of people using one-bys in gravel, but in a lot of ways, gravel has more demands for a wider gear range than road cycling does, just because there's, you know, there's steeper downhills and there's steeper uphills. So, yeah. So they need a wider range. So I think a classified hub for gravel makes great sense.
Yeah. And the problem with one boy, I've had aerodynamicists on the podcast, you're almost never in a drivetrain efficient position because you can't keep a straight chain line really with the one boy. You're constantly at an angle and the losses are bigger than I ever would have thought from, you know, I can't remember the exact stat, but I think it's like 8 watts difference from going from a 13 to an 11, which is a huge drop that you would never anticipate. So that is definitely a consideration. But something that I wondered in mountain biking, when I raced on the tandem, I raced briefly, we've tried to qualify for Tokyo on the tandem as part of the Irish Pursuit. Myself and Peter Ryan, and some of the technology we tried on the tandem was a rubber chain. And this was really interesting because obviously there's no tandem specific parts. Anything on a tandem, we've had to just create it. Like they don't make chains that long. You have to just join two Dura-Ace chains together. And then obviously there's an inherent weakness in that. So some tandem companies have innovated and they have this rubber belt. And I thought that's really interesting because it stops a lot of those problems around mud, but they're not quite there with it yet because you're losing power with the inherent stretch in the rubber, even though it's quite a hardened rubber. But I wonder if there's something like that coming down the pipeline.
Yeah, I know like the Gates belt drive bikes, God, there's a lot of, they're quiet for one, which is,
yeah,
which is cool. Of course, then it takes some, you know, internal gear drives, which are heavier and have some drag associated with them. The other problem is getting mud in a rubber belt can be an issue. Although I think that it depends how they have guides and stuff to keep the mud out of the actual teeth, because it's not a problem with chain teeth, but they're a lot sharper, so it squeezes the mud out of the engagement.
What's the big events for you this year? What are you looking forward to?
Well, the Iron Horse Classic, that's always a big deal for me. And it's only a 50-mile road race, but it's got 6,000 feet of climbing. It's Memorial Day weekend. I have done it, I think I've done it like 45 times. So so that's a big deal. That gets some notice because I've done it so many times. And anyway, it's a big local race. But we have an Omnium this year, where the road race is on Saturday and there's a gravel race on Sunday. So a combination of those two, that puts a new twist on it. Yeah. We also have a mountain bike race on Sunday as well. So there's an Omnium for the road race and the mountain bike race. And we've had that in the past, but this year, because gravel's getting so popular, we're going to do a road gravel Omnium. So that should be good.
Are you more competitive on the road or mountain bike these days?
I would say if there's a way that age has affected me, and maybe it's just a self-preservation thing on the mountain bike, but hand-eye coordination and vision, you know, I never used to wear glasses, but I'm 68 years old. So naturally, and now I've been experimenting with different prescription lenses and stuff. The guys at Oakley have been helping me out. And that's helped a lot because there was kind of a transition period in there where my eyes weren't that bad. So I didn't really want to wear prescription lenses. And now that I've kind of embraced wearing prescription on the mountain bike, that's helped a lot. But I don't know if guys are just going so much faster on the mountain bike technically, but I would say if there's an area I struggle, which is hurting me, it's technical riding. And my fitness is still pretty good. So gravel is kind of a nice in between, right? Because it takes some bike handling skills. Yes. And it's kind of more pure fitness oriented and less about technical riding.
Will you throw in a Leadville 100 this year?
No, I'll go there and work on the bike expo because we'll be talking about
that's a cough out.
Yeah, you know, I don't embrace the longer distance riding. You know, I like doing something like the Crusher and the Tusher, which is like a 65-mile gravel race with a ton of climbing. And that's about as far as I like to ride, three or four hours. And generally my training tends to be two and a half hours. That's just kind of the distance I like to ride. I like to tend to ride harder. I don't do a lot of long zone two training rides. So trying to do an event like Leadville on the kind of riding I do is pretty tough.
Ed, one of the legends of mountain biking. It was a pleasure to catch you up. Thank you so much for making the time for this.
Thanks, Anthony. It was good talking to you.